Good evening. I'd like to welcome you all here this evening. When I got the email about Omar Barghouti's tour, I forwarded it to Scott Kennedy, and he said right away, "We want him." And he wanted a particular time, and that time wasn't available. So the last conversation I had with Scott, he said, "We want him Sunday night at 7. So here we are, Sunday night at 7, and we are honored to have Omar Barghouti with us. He is an independent Palestinian commentator and human rights activist. He was educated at Columbia University in New York City, getting his bachelor and master's in electrical engineering there, and is one of the founding members of the Palestinian academic and cultural boycott of Israel, and the author of a book on boycott, divestment, and sanctions, which he will be telling you more about this evening. And we are just so thrilled to welcome Omar Barghouti with us this evening.
Thank you. Thank you very much for giving me permission to speak on your traditional territory. It is not just a gesture, it's the minimal duty to ask for this permission and to recognize and respect your traditional culture and your traditional territory. So thank you very much. I appreciate it. Okay, since we can't see the screen, I'll have to speak and look at the screen with you. I'll be doing a PowerPoint presentation. My talk is about boycott, divestment, and sanctions, or BDS, the legacy of Mandela and King specifically. So I'll talk about the global BDS movement, and I'll try to connect it to the situation in the US and answer the question, why should we care in the US? I'll try at least. Martin Luther King said, for those who can't read, I'll read it, "The deep rumbling of discontent that we hear today is the thunder of disinherited masses rising from dungeons of oppression to the bright hills of freedom. In one majestic chorus, the rising masses singing, 'Ain't gonna let nobody turn us around.'" And of course, Nelson Mandela, a great inspiration for our movement, famously said, "Our freedom is incomplete without the freedom of the Palestinians." You have a map, so you don't need me to explain much about it, but I'll just go over it very quickly. From the left, this is the area of Palestine, pre-1948, under the British mandate. The UN partition plan divided it into the yellow part, which is the Arab state, and the white part, which was announced as the Jewish state. But the Zionist militias occupied far more and took the entire white area in the third picture you see there. So that became the State of Israel pre-1967, and the yellow part was the West Bank, Gaza, the 1967 territory. And today, the yellow patches are the Bantustans that are left from historic Palestine to the Palestinian people. Everything else is controlled by Israel. So when we talk about the people of Palestine, we're talking about three groups, three main divisions due to the successive occupations. The great majority are not in the occupied territories. So many people, when they say the Palestinian people, and they refer to the West Bank, including East Jerusalem and Gaza, they're talking about slightly over one-third of the Palestinian people. Specifically, 38% of the Palestinians live in the occupied West Bank and Gaza. 12% are Palestinian citizens of Israel, and 50%, half of the Palestinian people, are in exile. Those who were ethnically cleansed in the Nakba of 1948, and whose villages and towns were destroyed so that they can never come back, and until now they're not allowed back, according to UN resolutions, which stipulates that they should be allowed to go back because they're the wrong type, because they're not Jewish. So, putting it another way, 37% of the Palestinians live in the occupied Palestinian territory, while 63% live outside the occupied Palestinian territory. more than two-thirds. So the BDS call, which was issued by a great majority of Palestinian civil society in 2005, called for the basic UN-sanctioned rights of all three Palestinian communities. It called for ending the 1967 occupation and colonization of the West Bank and Gaza. The second is ending the system of racial discrimination in Israel, which is a form of apartheid, according to the UN definition of apartheid. Third, and most importantly, the right of return for the refugees, because the great majority of the Palestinian people are refugees. The question of Palestine is first and foremost the question of refugees. So without discussing the right of return for refugees, we're not solving the question of Palestine. And we called for the BDS movement. We started the BDS movement mainly because the UN, under US hegemony, was completely unable or unwilling to bring us our rights, to defend our rights. Specifically, the call came out 1 year after the International Court of Justice at The Hague ruled that Israel's wall and colonies built on occupied territories were illegal under international law. So 1 year after, we saw that the international community was unable to even stop Israel's wall, let alone the right of return and ending occupation and ending apartheid. So we had to resort to the conscientious citizens of the world, as the South Africans had done before us in their anti-apartheid struggle. So the BDS movement, which is a global movement today, is led by the largest, by far, the absolute largest coalition of Palestinian civil society groups. And it's called the BDS National Committee, or the BNC. Trade unions, women's unions, political parties, students, youth, just about everyone is part of the BNC. So again, we're calling for three rights, not just ending the occupation, ending racial discrimination, and the right of return for refugees. Without that, we cannot exercise our right to self-determination. As far as the 1967 territory, the occupation, there's so many manifestations. Many of you know a lot about the occupation, so I'll just go over this very quickly. From the occupation of East Jerusalem to the acts of genocide in Gaza, and this is a term I put in quotes, used by Richard Folk, who's the UN Rapporteur for Human Rights, and he happens to be Jewish. And the last part says Arabs to the gas chambers, in case you cannot see it. This is in Hebron, in occupied Hebron, written by Jewish settlers, fanatic settlers. Another manifestation is army t-shirts. Israeli army platoons compete who can produce the most repulsive, racist t-shirt. This t-shirt has the crosshairs on a Palestinian pregnant woman's belly, and it says, one shot, two kills. Another aspect of the occupation is what was done in Gaza. When Israel bombed UN schools, shelters, mosques, hospitals using white phosphorus, indiscriminately burning people alive. Amnesty International addressed another aspect of Israel's suppression of Palestinian rights, denial of access to water. Amnesty issued an excellent report in October 2009 about Israel's denial of Palestinian access to water and about the contamination of the water supplies in Gaza. 90 to 95% of the water supply in Gaza is unfit for human consumption. This was deliberately done, destroying the water cleaning projects, destroying the sewage system, mixing water with sewage, to the extent that there is a very high level of nitrate pollution in the water supply in Gaza, which has led to a new blood disorder in newborn babies called methemoglobinemia. This is a completely new thing that we have not seen before. And this disease has symptoms such as Palestinian babies are born with blue hands, blue feet, sometimes their entire bodies are blue. They have respiratory convulsions, diarrhea, and sometimes they die when the nitrate level is too high. And of course, our children were used as human shields throughout Israel's occupation, but especially in the last decade. And the wall. I don't need to speak about the wall, the ghettoization of the Palestinians. as far as Israel itself within its 1948 borders is concerned. If we forget the occupied territories, Israel itself has dozens of laws that discriminate between its Jewish citizens and its non-Jewish citizens, the indigenous Palestinians. From land ownership to jobs to in every aspect, education, health, in every vital domain, there's a clear-cut legal discrimination between Israel's citizens who are Jewish and those who are not Jewish. In fact, Israel has a two-tiered legal system. It has citizenship and nationality. If you're Palestinian, born in Israel, like my wife, you become a citizen, but never a national. You have to be Jewish to be a national. Any Jewish person in this room is automatically a national of the State of Israel, while my wife, who was born there, is not. You have to be Jewish to be a national of the State of Israel. And accordingly, you're entitled to the full set of rights if you're a national. If you're just a citizen, you get certain parts of rights. For example, land ownership. 93% of the land is only available for nationals, for the Jewish nation. If you're Palestinian, even if your land was confiscated during the Nakba of 1948, you're not allowed to live on, to lease, to buy land on 93% of the area of today's Israel. Houses of prayers were desecrated since the Nakba. One church, the Church of Ma'lul, which is a Roman Catholic church, since the Nakba till 2005 was used as a cattle shed. This mosque of Ayn Haud, which is a village, a beautiful village near Haifa, was turned into an Israeli bar restaurant. And the entire village of Ayn Haud has a very peculiar story. Unlike the other 500 villages that were ethnically cleansed and bulldozed to the ground so that the refugees cannot come back, Ayn Haud, which is particularly beautiful, was kept intact. It has those picturesque houses and gardens. It was kept intact. It was not bulldozed. Every Palestinian was pushed out, ethnically cleansed, and it was turned into a Jewish artist colony. But unlike the rest of the villages, most of the villagers of Ayn Haud were pushed out just a couple of kilometers away from their village. They established a refugee camp within Israel. We're not talking about the West Bank or Gaza. This is within Israel today. They have an unrecognized village, which they called Ayn Haud, and every day they wake up to see their village, their houses, their gardens, occupied by otherwise liberal Jewish artists. Can you imagine the torture? It would be much easier for a refugee in Lebanon who just cannot see his or her village. Those refugees see their houses every single day occupied. And Al-Araqib, a Bedouin village in the Naqab, in the Negev desert, in the south of what's today Israel. This village is one of many dozens of unrecognized villages, they call them. Of course, they were living in those villages hundreds and hundreds of years before the establishment of Israel. But the state does not recognize them because it wants to confiscate their land. It wants to push them out of the land, exactly like was done to the indigenous, to the Native Americans in this country. Pushed out, not genocide, but the pushing out and putting them in little reservations. That's exactly what Israel is still doing today. Exactly. This village was destroyed dozens of times, and every time it was rebuilt with help from progressive Israelis, from internationals, from others. And every time the bulldozers come and destroy it again. But the people hold the sign, "We steadfast here," it says in Arabic. Another aspect of the Nakba, the 1948 Nakba, that people do not know of is destroying Palestinian books. A Jewish Israeli scholar from Ben-Gurion University, who just did his PhD on this issue, revealed that during the Nakba, Israel stole, Zionist militias and later the State of Israel, stole books from every Palestinian library, private libraries, public libraries, rich families' libraries, and destroyed tens of thousands of those books in a plan, according to this Jewish-Israeli scholar, to Judaize the country, to say that there was never Arab culture here. The books remind you of the 1930s in Europe. And of course, we talked about the occupation of 1967, the Nakba of 1948, and the racial discrimination. The refugees remain the core of the question of Palestine, denied from the right to return. What does this have to do with the US? Well, let's put it in a global context. According to a Brown University study issued a few weeks ago, the US has spent in the last decade $4 trillion, $4,000 billion on its wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan. It's a number that most of us cannot fathom. What does that mean, $4,000 billion? But imagine what that can do to services in this country, to hospitals, to education, to jobs, to everything, roads in this country, to employment in this country. Well, Israel fits exactly at the center of this agenda of wars and pillage and ethnic cleansing. This perpetual war is good for business, but which business? So when people say Israel is good for the US interest, it is, but which US? Define US interest. It's good for the 1%. It's good for the military companies, for Raytheon, for McDonnell Douglas. It's good for the oil companies, it's good for the banks, it's good for the homeland security. That's the 1% that benefits from Israel's ongoing occupation colonization. The 99% of the US does not benefit from this war agenda. It loses in this war agenda, and so do we. So the question of Palestine is the question of the global 99%. It's part of that agenda for social justice, for freedom, for equal rights for everyone. And we know what this $4 trillion was spent on in Iraq, for example, or in Afghanistan, where the US was liberating Afghani children and women, of course. And racism abroad becomes also racism at home, and vice versa. Racism feeds itself. Despite Israel's record of human rights violations and violations of international law, the US between 2009 and 2018 has committed and started paying $30 billion in military aid to Israel. Despite your financial crisis, despite everything in this country, you can afford to pay Israel $30 billion in those 10 years. And if we look, I'll skip this for the sake of time. If we look at the state of California's share of this $30 billion, that would come out to $3.48 billion California will spend in this 10-year period in military aid to Israel. This can translate instead into 42,000 affordable housing units or sustainable jobs, 57,000 sustainable jobs, or primary health care. That's just the state of California. Those numbers are from the US Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation website. So why is everyone silent about this, about Israel's role in all this? Desmond Tutu says, the Israeli government is placed on a pedestal in the US, and to criticize it is to be immediately dubbed anti-Semitic, as if the Palestinians were not Semitic. People are scared in this country to say wrong is wrong. Mearsheimer and Wolt revealed that Israel's lobby, the neoconservative lobby, played a key role in fanning the flames of war against Iraq. And it's doing exactly the same today against Iran. It's repeating the exact same fabrications and media hype to say Iran is the biggest threat on earth, let's go bomb Iran. So Israel is playing, it's not the only player. All these military companies would love to have another war because they want to sell hardware. It's good for the profits of the CEOs and the stockholders and so on. But Israel is certainly playing a key role in pushing for more wars. And silence, as Desmond Tutu has said, is complicity. That's not an option because your tax money is being used to maintain the system of oppression. So you can't say, well, it's none of my business, I don't do politics. You are doing politics. Your money is maintaining our oppression. So ending that complicity is a minimal moral obligation. It's not heroic. We're not asking you to come and struggle with us in Bil'in and Ni'alin and Nabi Saleh against the wall. We're not. That's a higher level. Those of you who are really committed, at a very basic level, we're asking you to stop complicity. If you're part of a church, part of a pension fund, part of a university, part of any association that's invested and is profiting from the occupation, you're complicit. And we're asking you to stop that complicity because we cannot do it alone. We cannot end Israel's occupation and apartheid alone while you're feeding it with billions and billions and billions of dollars, which you could better use for your health services, education, and jobs. So what are we seeking? Peace. We're very nervous when we hear this word peace without justice. The oppressed really have no affinity whatsoever to this term. Whenever it's dissociated, divorced from justice, it's meaningless to us. In fact, it's worse than meaningless. Peace without justice means institutionalizing injustice. Masters would love to have the slaves stop resisting. That would be peaceful. Well, let's have our peace. Well, we won't have that peace. We want justice. To have peace, the only peace we understand is that based on justice. Otherwise, it's not worth its name. And it's not enough to do some cosmetic changes where the master gives us some more bones or some more crumbs and we become happy slaves. That's no just peace either. As Desmond Tutu said, in fact, in a hearing in front of Congress, while they were still struggling against apartheid, we do not want our chains comfortable, we want them removed. Don't relax the chains and keep us under, break the chains. So the BDS movement is very inspired by the legacy of Mandela and King and Gandhi. But it's an authentic, rooted Palestinian movement, first and foremost. It is rooted in decades of Palestinian civil and popular resistance against settler colonialism and later occupation and apartheid. If you go back as far as 1933 to Jaffa, to the massive demonstrations, especially the dock workers' demonstrations against the onset of settler colonialism and the beginning of pushing Palestinian peasants off their lands. This was predominantly civil, popular, peaceful resistance that you wouldn't hear about in your media. That's the main root of BDS. Or our artistic and poetic and literary resistance. Palestinians are so proud of our literary history. We have so many poets and writers and musicians and dancers and all kinds of literary and cultural expression that was always part of our resistance. And the First Intifada, which started in 1987, with all its boycotts and massive community initiatives everywhere. This is from Bir Zeit University, large demonstration. And as some of you may know, right after the First Intifada broke out in 1987, a couple of months later, Israel shut down all 6 Palestinian universities, and then it shut down all Palestinian schools, and then it shut down all kindergartens. Palestinian education became illegal by military order. If a Palestinian child was held with a textbook, he or she was arrested and the book confiscated and destroyed because they were violating military orders. In fact, the Jerusalem Post at the time reported without any sense of irony that the Israeli army caught a clandestine class in East Jerusalem. Professors from Bir Zeit were teaching classes secretly. And they had no sense of irony. They really reported this, you know, big titles. And another image from Beit Sahur of Palestinian popular resistance. So education itself, even at the school level, became a struggle, a form of asserting our identity, because quite often the road to schools were blocked by the Israeli army, preventing our school children from reaching their very schools. And of course, all this Palestinian popular resistance inspired not just the BDS movement, it inspired the Arab Spring. Many of the leaders of the Arab Spring in Egypt, Tunisia, and Yemen, and elsewhere, always say that the Palestinian resistance played a key role in inspiring us. And that in turn, the Arab Spring inspired the Occupy movement in this country, which is inspiring us and the entire world. The entire world community was waiting for the US to wake up. So it is awakening. You're not awake yet, but awakening. And that's a great step forward. For decades and decades, there was nothing going on. I mean, since Vietnam, there was nothing going on. No social protest in this country. You have this weird ritual that we outside the US watch. Every 4 years, you have this tendency to go throw some piece of paper in a box, and we never understood what that meant. It's this, I don't know, religious ritual or something. And this piece of paper carries some information that leads to absolute no change, and you go home and you're happy that you expressed your will. Well, from the outside world, we look at it differently. Anyway. So, of course, when the Occupy movement started, we raised the slogan, Occupy Wall Street, not Palestine. And the BDS National Committee issued a statement exactly with that title. Now, an issue related to BDS is parity. Some people say, okay, this makes sense, it's a morally sound campaign and everything, but we want to be balanced. We want to hear both sides, we want to be fair, we want to be balanced and symmetric and so on. Mandela had something today to say about this. He warned against this exactly. He said, we can easily be enticed to read reconciliation and fairness as meaning parity between justice and injustice. And in the South African struggle, they always rejected this parity. Whenever the US and Britain tried to get them together, sit with the apartheid leaders and let's reach some common ground, some middle ground, why won't you compromise? And the South African leaders were saying always, no compromise on our basic rights. End apartheid and then we can talk. Without abolishing apartheid, there is no compromise. And this is a very important lesson that we in the Palestinian Nonviolent Resistance Movement, especially in BDS, have understood clearly. And we have a lot of contacts with South African leaders of the anti-apartheid movement. And another issue that always comes up in relation to BDS, people who say, you know, I really support Israel, I just have a problem with the occupation. That's the same as saying in the 1700s, I really support the US, but I'm against slavery. You know, minor problem, slavery, but the US is otherwise a wonderful country. Or South Africa, pre-freedom, saying, I support South Africa, but I'm against apartheid. It sounds ludicrous, but when mentioned in the Israeli context, it doesn't sound ludicrous. So many people say this. I support Israel, but I'm against the occupation. Well, guess what? Israel is the occupation. It's not like an external entity that has nothing to do with Israel, or a minor problem that Israel has. Israel is the country perpetrating the occupation and denial of rights. So you can't support Israel and be against the occupation. What does that mean? So what we're stressing is that despite the fact that Israel is the fourth strongest army in the world, despite being a huge nuclear power, we believe that moral right can win over military might. In the BDS movement, we rely completely on international law, universal human rights, and our moral right. And from the record of the last 7 years, we're seeing the limits of Israel's power. Despite its nuclear arsenal, it's not able to stop the BDS movement. In fact, they tried every trick in the book, and nothing has worked. From anti-Semitism charges to intimidation to bullying, and they're still doing it. Everywhere they're doing it, but it's not working. BDS is spreading across campuses, across church groups, across Jewish groups, and that's very scary for Israel. After the massacre in Gaza in 2009, many Jewish groups who were sitting on the fence have gotten off the fence and joined either the BDS movement directly or started doing BDS work, even if they haven't joined the BDS movement. So, a main part of BDS is economic boycott. And I'll give some success stories. Veolia, a French company that's involved in building the Jerusalem Light Rail, which is a tram connecting Israel's colonies in and around Jerusalem with the city of Jerusalem. Veolia and Alstom, two French companies. In November 2008, in Bilbao, the Basque country in Spain, we had a conference where we put a strategy of what campaigns we want to launch in Europe. Veolia was one of our main targets. Since November 2008 till now, Veolia lost contracts worth $12 billion and running and counting. Most of these were citizens like you pressuring city councils to exclude Veolia from public bids. Veolia has contracts, I'm sure, in California, everywhere. Water, sanitation, transportation. Veolia is one of the largest corporations on earth that are benefiting from the privatization of sanitation and water supply and so on. Alstom, the other company I mentioned, just recently lost a contract worth $9.4 billion in Saudi Arabia. It took us 3 years of pressure, 3 years of raising awareness until we finally got this result. It wouldn't have happened without the Arab Spring, because pre-Egypt and Tunisia, it fell on deaf ears. We tried and tried and tried, and there was no response from Saudi Arabia. And then suddenly after Tunisia and Egypt, they were more attentive, let's put it. So Alstom lost in one shot $9.4 billion contract. So what we're trying to say is that it is no longer free to support Israel. It carries a price tag. Another huge win was the government of Norway, the third largest sovereign fund in the world, was pressured by the BDS National Committee, by Adala New York, a BDS group in New York, by Who Profits, the Israeli Coalition of Women for Peace, which has this whoprofits.org website. It's an excellent database of companies profiting from the occupation. All three of us pressured the Norwegians, the pension fund, to divest from Israeli companies implicated in human rights violations and the occupation. And finally, we did succeed. They divested from Elbit Systems, Israel's largest military manufacturer, and Africa Israel, a real estate and among many other things, Israeli company. Another huge victory was against Agrexco. Agrexco was the largest Israeli exporter of produce, vegetables and fruits. For decades, it was this iconic company that Israel was so proud of, and it has invaded European markets, and to an extent, US market, but also Australia, Latin America. Agrexco was everywhere, under different labels, sometimes Carmel, sometimes different labels. That was one of the companies we targeted in that Bilbao conference I told you about in 2008. And the French took this very seriously, the French BDS partners. They established this massive coalition, including five national political parties and 95 NGOs, including many Jewish groups, peasants, unions, and so on. And they targeted Agrexco in France. And there was a similar campaign in Italy and in Spain and Scandinavia and in the UK and in Ireland. So Agrexco sales started going sharply down. This was one of the factors, not the only one, but one of the key factors behind Agrexco's bankruptcy a few weeks ago. In the trade union movement, we have massive support from CUSATU, the South African Trade Union Federation, the Brazilian CUT. The Brazilian Federation has 22 million workers, lest you think they're minor. The Irish Congress of Trade Unions, the Scottish, the British has about 7 million workers, and some French unions and Italian unions and Canadian unions and so on. So BDS has really reached the ivory tower. It has reached the intellectual community, the artists, the academics, but also the trade unions with their large bases of membership. One manifestation of this success with trade unions was our response to the Flotilla massacre, May 30th, 2010. If you remember when Israel attacked the Freedom Flotilla, the Mavi Marmara, and killed 9 humanitarian relief activists, everyone was extremely agitated, extremely angry. The BDS National Committee and our partners asked people around the world, don't get angry, do something about it. Make it impossible for Israel to repeat this crime. So we specifically called on dock workers, unions around the world to boycott Israeli ships. We used Mahmoud Darwish, one of the most famous Palestinian poets, poem, besiege your siege. If Israel is laying siege to Gaza, besiege Israel's ships. Refuse to load or offload Israeli ships. And to our pleasant surprise, the Swedish Dock Workers Union heeded our call and boycotted Israeli ships for 8 or 9 days. Cochin, the fourth largest port in India, boycotted Israeli ships for a number of days. Durban, South Africa, in Turkey, in Greece, and in Oakland, California. The Dock Workers Union in Oakland, California, for 24 historic hours, refused to offload an Israeli ship. We and the Israeli establishment smelled South Africa in that action, because Israel and we know that this was the beginning of the end of apartheid, when dock workers' unions started refusing to offload South African ships and to load South African ships. It was truly the beginning of the end. So resistance from inside South Africa to apartheid and solidarity in the form of boycott and divestment from the outside together did the trick in making apartheid collapse. And of course, the academic and cultural boycott campaign is an important key part of the BDS campaign. And in the US, we have our partners, US Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, which has the support of hundreds and hundreds of academics and artists and others, and it's helping a lot in pushing campus work in this country. So yes, BDS was in Canada from the start, but we'd like to say it crossed the Atlantic finally after Gaza and after the flotilla attack. We started seeing many wonderful creative campaigns in the US, BDS campaigns. Adala New York with their famous Christmas carols, subversive Christmas carols, pro-boycott. And of course, the US campaign to end the Israeli occupation, which adopted BDS, and many, many groups are part of the US campaign. So we're very proud of them as our strategic partner in the US. Code Pink and their very targeted campaign against Ahava, an Israeli cosmetics company that manufactures using minerals stolen from Palestinian occupied territories. So many targeted campaigns were launched in the US. And of course, the flash mob at Grand Central Station in New York. There were so many other flash mobs in Portland, Oregon, in San Francisco, everywhere. There were so many wonderful flash mobs in the US. And this has helped raise awareness among especially the younger generation, students and youth in this country, about BDS. It was a fun way to struggle. Still is. So BDS took on a lot of creativity and sustainability in campaigns in this country, in the UK, in France, in other South Africa and other places. And about Jewish groups, as I mentioned, that many jumped off the fence. Jewish Voice for Peace, which is the largest of the non-Zionist groups in this country, has not yet endorsed BDS. But they're leading one of the largest BDS campaigns in the US, the campaign against TIAA-CREF. TIAA-CREF is the largest pension fund in this country, and it handles pension funds from universities, health workers, some human rights groups like Amnesty, and so on and so forth. It's a huge, massive pension fund. Jewish Voice for Peace and many partners, but it's under the leadership of Jewish Voice for Peace, is targeting TIAA-CREF, trying to pressure them to divest from 5 companies that are profiting from Israel's occupation and human rights violations. The International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network, IJAN, with Scottish and Palestinian partners, is leading a campaign against the Jewish National Fund, which, as I said, is playing a major role in the colonization and ethnic cleansing in Palestine. And of course, American Jews for Just Peace. Hampshire College in 2009 was the first US college to divest from companies profiting from the occupation. And it also was, in the 1970s, the first American college to divest from apartheid South Africa. So they're the vanguard, Hampshire. But we also have Berkeley, the Berkeley battle. The Berkeley battle for divestment, as some of you may know, we won a majority, a large majority of students on the Student Council supporting the motion for divestment. But according to undemocratic policies of that student council, the president of the council vetoed. And we could not get the two-third majority to override his veto. And of course, we couldn't get that two-third majority. We were short, just one vote short to get the two-third majority. But the way we lost that, we really won. Desmond Tutu, Judith Butler, Noam Chomsky, Naomi Klein, many, many, many figures around the world supported the Berkeley divestment drive. Israel looked at it as a true war. They saw this as war. They established a war chamber. The Israeli ambassador in Washington, the Israeli consul general in the Bay Area, the entire lobby formed a war committee, basically. They were contacting students one by one, SMS by SMS, text messaging, email by email, telling them, you vote for that motion and you can kiss your career goodbye. Okay. Literally. No graduate school will accept you. No company will employ you. Full blown out intimidation and bullying was used against those students to convince them not to vote. Despite that, we got really just one short of 2/3. That's why I call it the Berkeley Battle. And of course, Students for Justice in Palestine held their first national conference at Columbia University in October 2011, which was a big step forward for student activism for BDS. And a BDS conference for students will be held at the University of Pennsylvania next month. So US campuses are really spearheading the BDS movement in this country. Churches, of course, the Presbyterians, the Methodists, the United Church of Christ, and others have taken positions condemning the occupation, rather, and calling for some form of ethical investment. However, all three have not put their money where their mouth is. They're still invested in the occupation. All three churches, all pension funds are still invested in the occupation, in Israel's violation of human rights. So what Palestinian civil society is telling communities of faith in the US, we don't need any more condemnation if it does not mean anything effective on the ground. If you're profiting from our misery, don't tell us you're standing in solidarity with us. We are sick and tired of meaningless solidarity gestures that are not associated with effective concrete action. And again, we're not asking for something heroic. We're asking you to clean your pension funds of every immoral investment in the occupation. We don't think that's too much to ask. Divest from companies that are maintaining our oppression. Our South African comrades asked you for this and you heeded their call. And you've done that in Burma, and you've done that in Darfur. You stood up for human rights with your money, not just with condemnation statements. Now is the time to do the same with Palestine. And I'll come back to that. And of course, Olympia Food Co-op's boycott of Israeli products was the first in the Western Hemisphere. This was a huge victory for the BDS movement. And as you would expect, the lobby is suing Olympia Food Co-op, the current board and the past board, for daring to take this precedent. So we need support to the Olympia Food Co-op, moral support, political support, any form of support we can give to maintain, to sustain that victory. Because BDS is about context sensitivity, campaigns that are sensitive to every context, and sustainability. We need to sustain our victories. We don't do BDS for fun. It is fun, but we don't do it for fun. We do it to get our rights back. So to get our rights, we need to sustain victories. We're not interested in victories that disappear or dissipate after a few months. We need to maintain those victories. In the cultural field, as I said, we gained the support of many key figures. Alice Walker said Rosa Parks would have supported BDS to soothe the pain and attend the sorrows of a people wrongly treated for generations. Stéphane Hessel, co-author of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and a Holocaust survivor, Jewish Holocaust survivor, obviously, said, BDS campaigns around the world present the most promising way to overcome the failure of world governments to stand up to Israel's intransigence and lawless behavior. Judith Butler, famous academic, linguist, philosopher, said BDS is the only way that citizens can call for the enforcement of international law. Angela Davis and many, many, many others have also endorsed BDS. So the cultural boycott really spread, with many artists refusing to play Israel, which is now painted as South Africa was during apartheid. So Tel Aviv, Sun City, the analogies are coming very clear to artists around the world. As a result, major artists are boycotting. And when one particular musical group was violating our boycott, Archbishop Desmond Tutu told them, just as we said during apartheid that it was inappropriate for international artists to perform in South Africa, in a society founded on discriminatory laws and racial exclusivity, so it would be wrong for Cape Town Opera to perform in Israel. Because Tel Aviv became Sun City. So Gil Scott-Heron, Elvis Costello, the Pixies, Snoop Dogg, Ken Loach, and many, many, many more are boycotting. They're heeding our call to boycott Israel culturally. Because Israel uses culture to normalize its apartheid system and occupation. And finally, back to the churches. Now the Presbyterians and the Methodists and the United Church of Christ and others started looking into divestment at a glacial rate before there was a Palestinian Christian voice that is clearly calling for BDS. But now, since 2009, we have that. There's the Kairos Palestine document issued by leaders in the Christian communities in Palestine from all denominations, Orthodox, Catholic, Protestant, everyone. The main denominations, major Christian leaders, issued the Kairos Palestine document, which is a theological Christian document about the obligation to resist injustice. And BDS was among the demands that the Kairos Palestine document called for. And it's very inspired by the Kairos South Africa, when church leaders in South Africa during apartheid called upon the world to boycott South Africa. And more recently, the Kairos Palestine group issued the Bethlehem Call. And this is a little cartoon of Jesus kicking the occupation in the butt. So action, not meditation. Meditation leading to action is fine, but meditation without action is not good. So in the Bethlehem Call, it calls for occupation no more, dismantling Israeli apartheid, and demand that the right of return for all Palestinian refugees be enforced. So they accepted the three main tenets of the BDS call, and they reiterated in the Bethlehem Call the support for BDS. I want to repeat the point that at the very basic level, what we're asking for, what we're asking you to do is do no harm. We're not asking you to go out of your way to help the struggle. At the very least, do no harm. End complicity. And BDS is a very effective way to do that. As I said, at a very basic level, divestment, but then people can join boycotts and pressure governments to adopt sanctions, because main Israeli establishment leaders now look at BDS as a strategic threat. And as Martin Luther King Jr. said, change does not roll in on the wheels of inevitability, but comes through continuous struggle. And so we must straighten our backs and work for our freedom. A man can't ride you unless your back is bent. And through BDS, we're trying to straighten our back for freedom, justice, and equality. That's what Martin Luther King would have done. Thank you.